The Risk Profession by Donald E. Westlake. Part 3. Carpin stood in the middle of the room, a small revolver in his hand. "Shut the door," he said. I obeyed, moving slowly. I didn't want that gun to go off by mistake. "Who are you?" Carpin demanded. The M&R man had been right. Ab Carpin was a dead ringer for all those other prospectors I'd seen back at Atronic City. Short and skinny and grizzled and ageless. He could have been 40 and he could have been 90, but he was probably somewhere the other side of 50. His hair was black and limp and thinning, ruffled in little wisps across his wrinkled pate. His forehead and cheeks were lined like a plowed field, and were much the same color. His eyes were wide apart and small, so deep-set beneath shaggy brows that they seemed black. His mouth was thin, almost lipless. The hand holding the revolver was nothing but bones and blue veins covered with taut skin. He was wearing a dirty undershirt and an old pair of trousers that had been cut off raggedly just above his knobby knees. Faded slippers were on his feet. He had good reason for dressing that way. The temperature inside the dome must have been nearly 90 degrees. The dome wasn't reflecting away the sun's heat as well as it had when it was young. I looked at Carpin, and despite the revolver and the tense expression on his face, he was the least dangerous-looking man I'd ever run across. All at once, the idea that this antisocial old geezer had the drive or the imagination to murder his partner seemed ridiculous. Apparently, I spent too much time looking him over, because he said again, "Who are you?" And this time, he motioned impatiently with the revolver. "Stanton," I told him. "Ged Stanton, Tangiers Mutual Insurance. I have identification, but it's in my pants pocket, down inside this suit." "Get it," he said, "and move slow." "Right you are." I moved slow, as per directions, and peeled out of the suit, then reached into my trouser pocket and took out my ID clip. I flipped it open and showed him the card bearing my signature and picture and right thumbprint and the name of the company I represented, and he nodded, satisfied, and tossed the revolver over onto his bed. "I gotta be careful," he said. "I got a big claim here." "I know that," I told him. "Congratulations for it." "Thanks," he said, but he still looked peevish. "You're here about Jafe's insurance, right?" "That I am." "Don't want to pay up, I suppose. That doesn't surprise me." Blunt old men irritate me. "Well," I said, "we do have to investigate." "Sure," he said. "You want some coffee?" "Thank you." "You can sit in that chair there. That was Jeff's." I settled gingerly in the cloth and plastic foldaway chair he'd pointed at, and he went over to the kitchen area of the dome to start coffee. I took the opportunity to look the dome over. It was the first portable dome I'd ever been inside. It was all one room, roughly circular, with a diameter of about 15 feet. The sides went straight up for the first 7 feet, then curved gradually inward to form the roof. At the center of the dome, the ceiling was about 12 feet high. The floor of the room was simply the asteroidal rock surface, not completely level and smooth. There were two chairs and a table to the right of the entry lock, two fold-away cots around the wall beyond them, the kitchen area next, and a cluttered storage area around on the other side. There was a heater standing alone in the center of the room, but it certainly wasn't needed now. Sweat was already trickling down the back of my neck and down my forehead into my eyebrows. I peeled off my shirt and used it to wipe sweat from my face. "Warm in here," I said.
"You get used to it," he muttered,
which I found hard to believe. He brought over the coffee and I tasted it. It was rotten, as bitter as this old hermit's soul. But I said, "Good coffee. Thanks a lot."
"I like it strong," he said.
I looked around at the room again. All the comforts of home, eh? Pretty ingenious arrangement.
"Sure," he said sourly. "How about getting to the point, mister? There's only one way to handle a blunt old man. Be blunt right back."
"I'll tell you how it is," I said. "The company isn't accusing you of anything, but it has to be sure everything's on the up and up before it pays out any 10,000 credits. And your partner just happening to fill out that cash return form just before he died. Well, you've got to admit it's a funny kind of coincidence."
"How so?"
He slurped coffee and glowered at me over the cup.
"We made this strike here," he said. "We knew it was the big one. Jeff had that insurance policy of his in case he never did make the big strike. As soon as we knew this was the big one, he said, 'I guess I don't need that retirement now,' and sat right down and wrote out the cash return. Then we opened a bottle of liquor and celebrated, and he got himself killed."
The way Carpin said it, it sounded smooth and natural. Too smooth and natural. "How did this accident happen, anyway?" I asked him.
"I'm not 100% sure of that myself," he said. "I was pretty well drunk myself by that time. But he put on his suit and said he was going out to paint the X. He was falling all over himself, and I tried to tell him it could wait till we'd had some sleep, but he wouldn't pay any attention to me.
So he went out," I said. He nodded.
"He went out first. After a couple minutes, I got lonesome in here, so I suited up and went out after him. It happened just as I was going out the lock, and I just barely got a glimpse of what happened."
He attacked the coffee again, noisily, and I prompted him, saying,
"What did happen, Mr. Carpin?"
"Well, he was capering around out there, waving the paint tube and such. There's a lot of sharp rocks sticking out around here. Just as I got outside, he lost his balance and kicked out, and scraped right into some of that rock and punctured his suit."
"I thought the body was lost," I said.
He nodded. "It was. The last thing in life Jafe ever did was to try and shove himself away from those rocks. That and the force of air coming out of that puncture for the first second or two was enough to throw him up off the surface. It threw him up too high, and he never got back down."
My doubt must have showed in my face, because he added,
"Mister, there isn't enough gravity on this place to shoot craps with."
He was right. As we talked, I kept finding myself holding unnecessarily tight to the arms of the chair. I kept having the feeling I was going to float out of the chair and hover around up at the top of the dome if I were to let go. It was silly, of course. There was some gravity on that planetoid, after all. But I just don't seem to get used to low G. Nevertheless, I still had some more questions.
"Didn't you try to get his body back? Couldn't you have reached him?" "I tried to, mister," he said. "Old Jeff McCann was my partner for 15 years. But I was drunk, and that's a fact. And I was afraid to go jumping up in the air for fear I'd go floating away, too.
Frankly, I said, I'm no expert on low gravity and asteroids, but wouldn't McCann's body just go into orbit around this rock? I mean, it wouldn't simply go floating off into space, would it?
It sure would, he said. There's a lot of other rocks out here too, mister, and a lot of them are bigger than this one and have a lot more gravity pull. I don't suppose there's a navigator in the business who could have computed Jafe's course in advance. He floated up, and then he floated back over the dome here, and seemed to hover for a couple minutes. And then he just floated out and away. His isn't the only body circling around the sun with all these rocks, you know.
I chewed a lip and thought it over. I didn't know enough about asteroid gravity or the conditions out here to be able to say for sure whether Karpin's story were true or not. Up to this point, I couldn't attack the problem on a fact basis. I had to depend on feeling now, the hunches and instincts of 8 years in this job, hearing some people tell lies and other people tell the truth. And my instinct said, Ab Karpin was lying through his teeth. That dramatic little touch about McCann's body hovering over the dome before disappearing into the void, that sounded more like the embellishment of fiction than the circumstance of truth. And the string of coincidences were just too much. McCann just coincidentally happens to die right after he and his partner make their big strike. He happens to write out the cash return form just before dying, and his body just happens to float away so nobody can look at it and check Karpin's story. But no matter what my instinct said, the story was smooth. It was smooth as glass, and there was no place for me to get a grip on it. What now? There wasn't any hole in Karpin's story, at least none that I could see. I had to break his story somehow, and in order to do that, I had to do some nosing around on this planetoid. I couldn't know in advance what I was looking for. I could only look. I'd know it when I found it. It would be something that conflicted with Karpin's story. And for that, I had to be sure the story was complete. You said McCann had gone out to paint the X, I said. Did he paint it? Karpin shook his head. He never got the chance. He spent all his time dancing up till he went and killed himself. So you painted it yourself? He nodded. And then you went on into Atronic City and registered the claim? Is that the story? No. Chemisant City was closer than Atronic City right then, so I went there. Just after Jeff's death and everything. I didn't feel like being alone any more than I had to. You said Chemisant City was closer to you then. Isn't it now?
Things move around a lot out here, mister, he said. Right now, Chemisant City's almost twice as far from here as Atronic City. In about 3 days, it'll start swinging in closer again. Things keep shifting around out here.
So I've noticed, I said. When you took off to go to Chemisant City, didn't you make a try for your partner's body then?
He shook his head. He was long out of sight by then, he said. That was 10-11 hours later, when I took off.
Why's that? All you had to do was paint the X and take off.
Mister, I told you. I was drunk. I was falling down drunk. And when I saw I couldn't get at Jafe, and he was dead anyway,
I came back in here and slept it off. Maybe if I'd been sober, I would have taken the scooter and gone after him. But I was drunk.
I see.
And there just weren't any more questions I could think of to ask. Not right now. So I said, I've just had a shaky 4-hour ride coming out here. Mind if I stick around a while before I go back?
Help yourself, he said, in a pretty poor attempt at genial hospitality. You can sleep over if you want.
Fine, I said. I think I'd like that.
You wouldn't happen to play cribbage, would you?
He asked, with the first real sign of animation I'd seen in him yet. I learn fast, I told him.
Okay, he said. I'll teach you.
And he produced a filthy deck of cards and taught me. After losing 9 straight games of cribbage, I quit and got to my feet. I was at my most casual as I stretched and said,
Okay, if I wander around outside for a while? I've never been on an asteroid like this before.
I mean, a little one like this. I've just been to the company cities up to now.
Go right ahead, he said. I've got some polishing and patching to do anyway.
He made his voice sound easy and innocent, but I noticed his eyes were alert and wary, watching me as I struggled back into my suit. I didn't bother to put my shirt back on first, and that was a mistake. The temperature inside an atmosphere suit is a steady 68 degrees. That had never seemed particularly chilly before, but after the heat of that dome, it seemed as cold as a blizzard inside the suit. I went on out through the airlock and moved as briskly as possible in the cumbersome suit while the sweat chilled on my back and face, and I accepted the glum conviction that one thing I was going to get out of this trip for sure was a nasty head cold. I went over to the X first and stood looking at it. It was just an X, that's all, shakily scrawled in yellow paint with the initials J.A., scrawled much smaller beside it. I left the X and clumped away. The horizon was practically at arm's length, so it didn't take long for the dome to be out of sight. And then I clumped more slowly, studying the surface of the asteroid. What I was looking for was a grave. I believed that Karpin was lying, that he had murdered his partner. And I didn't believe that Jeff McCann's body had floated off into space. I was convinced that his body was still somewhere on this asteroid. Karpin had been forced to concoct a story about the body being lost because the appearance of the body would prove somehow that it had been murder and not accident. I was convinced of that, and now all I had to do was prove it. That asteroid was a pretty unlikely place for a grave. That wasn't dirt I was walking on. It was rock. Solid, metallic rock. You don't dig a grave in solid rock. Not with a shovel. You maybe can do it with dynamite, but that won't work too well if your object is to keep anybody from seeing that the hole has been made. Dirt can be patted down. Blown up rock looks like blown up rock, and that's all there is to it. I considered crevices and fissures in the surface, some cranny large enough for Karpin to have stuffed the body into. But I didn't find any of those either as I plodded along, being sure to keep one magneted boot always in contact with the ground. Karpin and McCann had set their dome up at just about the only really level spot on that entire planetoid. The rest of it was nothing but jagged rock, and it wasn't easy traveling at all, maneuvering around with magnets on my boots and a bulky atmosphere suit cramping my movements. And then I stopped and looked out at space and cursed myself for a ring-tailed baboon. McCann's body might be anywhere in the solar system, anywhere at all, but there was one place I could be sure it wasn't, and that place was this asteroid. No Carpen had not blown a grave or stuffed the body into a fissure in the ground. Why not? Because this chunk of rock was valuable. That's why not. Because Carpen was in the process of selling it to one of the major companies, and that company would come along and chop this chunk of rock into pieces, getting the valuable metal out. And McCann's body would turn up in the first week of operations if Carpen were stupid enough to bury it here. 10 hours between McCann's death and Carpen's departure for Chemisant City. He'd admitted that already. And I was willing to bet he'd spent at least part of that time carrying McCann's body to some other asteroid, one he was sure was nothing but worthless rock. If that were true, it meant the mortal remains of Jaff McCann were now somewhere, anywhere, in the asteroid belt. Even if I assumed that the body had been hidden on an asteroid somewhere between here and Chemisant City, which wasn't necessarily so, that wouldn't help at all. The relative positions of planetoids in the belt just keep on shifting. A small chunk of rock that was between here and Chemisant City a few weeks ago, it could be almost anywhere in the belt right now. The body. That was the main item. I'd more or less counted on finding it somehow. At the moment, I couldn't think of any other angle for attacking Carpen's story. As I clopped morosely back to the dome, I nibbled at Carpen's story in my mind. For instance, why go to Chemisant City? It was closer, he said. But it couldn't have been closer by more than a couple of hours. The way I understood it, Carpen was well known back on Atronic City. It was the normal base of operations for he and his partner. And he didn't know a soul at Chemisant City. Did it make sense for him to go somewhere he wasn't known after his partner's death, even if it was an hour closer? No. It made a lot more sense for a man in that situation to go where he's known. Go somewhere where he has friends who'll sympathize with him and help him over the shock of losing a partner of 15 years standing. Even if going there does mean traveling an hour longer. And there was always the cash return form. That was what I was here about in the first place. Just didn't make sense for McCann to have held up his celebration while he filled out a form that he wouldn't be able to mail until he got back to Atronic City. And yet, the company's handwriting experts were convinced that it wasn't a forgery, and I could pretty well take their word for it. Mauling these things over as I tramped back toward the dome, I suddenly heard a distant bell ringing way back in my head. The glimmering of an idea. Not an idea yet, but just the hint of one. I wasn't sure where it led, or even if it led anywhere at all, but I was going to find out. End of part 3.